Tested live. Catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.
29 minutes past 9, and if you're on the streets, you must be freezing for whatever reasons. Please just tell us, why are you on the streets and how are you protecting yourself against the elements? It's very, very unbearable, I'd imagine, for the homeless folks on the streets. And if at all, are you doing something to give a hand out? But speaking of giving out a hand, so South Africa is saying that it is very committed to the Palestinian cause, and we're going to talk about this now. And looking at the outgoing minister, we're speaking about Dr. Naledi Pandor. She is on her way out of this parliament to low down on the ANC's candidate list after the party's ballot thrashing to leading to a dramatic reduction in parliamentary seats. So we understand that she's not going back in that role, but she says South Africa will continue to do everything in its power against the acts of genocide and apartheid. We know, of course, that there's also been a lot of backlash, even at public level, on the use of the term genocidal. Genocidal, it's been brought to the courts. It's a source of contention. Aisha Kaji, international relations expert, joins us now. A very good evening to you, and thank you so much for speaking to us, Aisha.
Thanks for having me, Tipiso, and good evening to you and your listeners.
So, interesting report coming out, the United Nations saying war crimes are being committed in Gaza. Mm-hmm. It's also warned that 1 million Gazans could face starvation in July as a result of the bombardment of Rafah. And there's been this constant question by critics about the use of the term genocide. I know there's the legal aspect, but there's also a moral aspect of it. Do you want to share with us your thoughts on all of this?
Well, I think, you know, judging by all the documentation that South Africa presented at the International Court of Justice in January and again in March and again last month in May, the supporting documentation seems to give a lot of substance to the concern that the South Africans have raised regarding a genocide in Gaza. I think it is certainly more than ethnic cleansing at this point. You know, there's been ethnic cleansing ongoing in Gaza and in the West Bank for at least the last 20 years. But what we are seeing now is targeted attempts to obliterate, at least in part, you know, the people who live in Gaza. And many of them are already refugees from the 1948 or the 1967 Nakba and clearances. So, you know, we're seeing a real attempt not only to kill people, including the elderly and children, but to make the conditions of life unsupportable. And that doesn't only include the issue of starvation, although, of course, that is one big aspect. There is also the issue of cultural and memory obliteration. And that is precisely what we've seen happen very systematically. We've seen the education system essentially devastated. We've seen the healthcare system obliterated. And we've seen, you know, buildings, housing, culture, memorial, churches, mosques, museums, art galleries, places of culture generally, just totally, totally destroyed. And so it seems to me, given that level of destruction, given that level of venom, if you want to call it that, and malevolence, really, because one cannot understand this level of destruction, of killing, of really wholesale murder at this point. Just a few days ago, the raid on the refugee camp at Al Nuseirat basically showed that what Israel and the U.S. are touting as a victory, yes, they rescued 4 hostages, but at the cost of over 280 lives and over 700 wounded. Is that really something to be celebrated?
I'd like to hear from you then why there seems to be, and I don't know, some people say put two economists together and they're likely to argue. So it's the same with lawyers as well, legal judicial fraternity. Article 62 and 63 of the statute of the court, particularly in terms of the application of the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. Why does Israel insist that what South Africa's application has been put forth does not meet these standards, and of course it has continually denied that?
I think it has no other defense, really. Israel has traditionally played the victim card, it's played the anti-Semite card, and yet you see Jews across the world also joining in the protest, also calling for ceasefire, etc. So this is not about religion. It is about that ethnicity and about the obliteration of an ethnic group. And given the convention, the genocide convention, the conditions of that have certainly been met, as has been underlined, as I said, in the supporting documentation that South Africa presented. In January, for example, the citing of the various instances of genocidal speech by senior members of the current administration in Israel, including the prime minister, including the finance minister, and including the defense minister. Add to that the footage taken by soldiers, by Israeli occupation force soldiers in Gaza, the celebration of wholesale devastation and slaughter, really, and this adds up to genocide. You've seen, take that in conjunction with what various rabbis have said, including the rabbis that train the military, and you see that there is certainly, at least in part of Israeli society, the intention for ethnic cleansing at the very least.
So the application by South Africa at the moment, according to a legal expert, saying that what they are asking the courts to do at this point in terms of enforcing what it had asked Israel to do, that the courts themselves will want to establish that the situation has changed on the ground since its last round of orders. What has been noted as an escalation, South Africa has pointed out the inability of the Security Council to act. We've seen the bickering over the wording ensuring that there's a ceasefire. What will it take?
It will take Mr. Biden to finally admit there is a red line. He keeps changing the goalpost. He said that the red line would be Rafah, and we've seen that it's not. Before that, he said that the red line would be Gaza City. We saw that wasn't the case. We saw that there's been evidence now, coming out from Gaza City and from other cities of mass graves in hospitals, for heaven's sake. If that is not clear evidence of at least a partial genocide, then tell me what is. It's similar to what we saw in Srebrenica, in Bosnia-Herzegovina. It's similar to what we saw in Rwanda in 1994. So really, the intent is very, very clear, and the evidence is overwhelming at the moment. And yet, the Biden administration continues to support the Netanyahu administration, despite the so-called red lines, which, as I said, keep moving. What it will take is for America to stop funding this genocide, for Britain to stop, also supporting this genocide, for Germany to stop. At least some of the other Western European nations have now indicated that they will abide by both the ICJ and, if the arrest warrants are issued on a personal basis at the ICC, they will abide by those, which will mean it will be very difficult for Mr. Netanyahu and Mr. Gallant to travel anywhere in any of those countries, because those countries are signatories to the Rome Statute of the ICC, and they will hand them over.
So we've seen Anthony Blinken saying that Hamas is not quite coming to the party in terms of the latest ceasefire plan. Israel criticizing South Africa on what it calls its it's continued to act as the legal arm of the Hamas terrorist organization. And yet there are reports of what is being described as a systematic escalation in what we've seen in some parts. I believe that there was an attack in East Jerusalem in the Old City by an Israeli soldier. Also looking at multilateralism, where many people have said it's failed the people of Palestine. But is it an issue of failure, or is it that countries are taking sides based on their binational relations? We've seen only a few European countries saying that they are now looking to change their position on the Middle East crisis.
Yes. We've seen Ireland, Belgium, France and Spain, among others, indicate that that they're now taking this very, very seriously. Spain actually indicating it wants to join the ICC case, against in support of Palestine at the ICC. So we have seen certainly some movement in Western Europe. But yes, a lot of the reluctance is traditionally, it's because of the traditional factors that have seen bilateral relations between Israel and these countries. Also bear in mind that Israel is a large supplier of both military hardware as well as surveillance technology to many countries. And that includes some of the most oppressive regimes around the world. Anthony Lowenstein's book, The Palestine Laboratory, lays out in quite shocking detail and horrific detail how Palestine, and particularly Gaza, have been used as guinea pigs on which to war test both military equipment and surveillance equipment. And so many of the countries who have been reluctant to condemn Israel have been reluctant to do so because they have been client states for this kind of technology, which they then use against their own people, often covertly when it comes to the surveillance equipment.
Aisha Kaji, let's continue with this conversation in a minute or two. We are just going to take a quick break and we'll return talking about the Middle East crisis, South Africa's role in it, and what is needed to effect a full-on ceasefire. And we'll also look at some of the figures, the report also being put out by the United Nations of what's actually happening in Palestine at the moment. It is 17 minutes to 10. We are still in conversation with Aisha Kaji, international relations expert. We are speaking about South Africa vying to continue its concerted efforts for the people of Palestine. And Aisha, just before we went on the break, we are going to take calls. By the way, Wendy, we see you. So if you'd like to call in and chat to us about this particularly contentious subject, I know it's very emotive. We are on 086-00-00959. We're speaking about figures earlier on. So Gaza's saying 37,202 people have been documented as killed, another 10,000 people missing. You spoke about children earlier on. They put that figure at 15,694 children, and saying that 17,000 children are living without either or with only one of their parents. But most importantly is the justification that Israel gives for its bombardment of Rafah, saying the last bastion of control or leadership of Hamas is in Rafah. What evidence is being presented, and how do you, it's an enclosure, the military operations, how exactly are they figured out? Just asking from a curious observer that I am.
You know, that's actually a very good question, Sipisa, because thus far, no evidence has actually been presented that there are senior Hamas commanders or even Hamas cells in Rafah. And thus far, as you said, close on 16,000 children have been killed. And the largest number in any conflict anywhere in the world in history of child amputees are now in Gaza. Some of them double, triple, and even quadruple amputees among children. And, you know, are those children Hamas? You know? The children that have been killed, the children whose limbs have been amputated, the actual targeting of, you know, fathers, that Hello Daddy surveillance program that was used to supposedly identify targets and then kill them at the time when they come home to their families. In other words, kill their families too.
Mm.
Even if they were legitimate targets, what is it about the families that also need to be destroyed? I'm not saying they were legitimate targets in the first place, because the technology that was used is very, very questionable. But I'm saying that even were they legitimate so-called Hamas targets, why kill them at the time when they come home to their families, in their family's home, so that the entire family gets obliterated?
Okay,
Is it really justifiable?
Hold your thought, because we do have Wendy on the line. Wendy calling from Johannesburg, who'd like to engage us on this issue.
Sure.
Wendy, very good evening.
Good evening, Tabiso. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling us. What's on your mind about this particular issue?
A couple of things, and I'm glad you're having this conversation with your guest at this time. A few things from my side. What might be helpful as a starting point in public conversations about what's going on specifically in Gaza and then generally in the occupied Palestinian territory is if we stop calling it a conflict in the way that we do in the media. Because there are clear regimes of oppression that are in operation here. The term conflict itself is being challenged, or has been challenged for several years in different quarters. There are three regimes of oppression that are operating here. A plausible genocide, as the ICJ has already stated, so there's no need to have any confusion around that. It's not whether it's genocide or not. The court has already said that there is a plausible genocide in Gaza. There is a military occupation that's been in operation since 1967, and there is a system of apartheid. So we don't need to confuse the listeners, with terms that are not helpful for them. In terms of...
But Wendy, can I just jump in there and ask this question? I think this is why I said to Aisha about the issue of a language writ, the plausible genocide. There was a great deal of argument about it, but why wasn't the court definitive?
At the time when the court made that statement, remember when it handed down its decision in January, right? And so that was the initial hearing, and that is the term that continues to be used. Now, if you look at what South Africa did, not at the International Court of Justice, but at the Security Council last week, South Africa invoked Article 94 of the Charter and proceeded to, again, present the evidence that your guest is talking about. The unequivocal, indisputable evidence of continued violations of the orders of the ICJ. Now, it's not only South Africa that has put forward the argument of genocide. It has come from many circles. It has come from the UN system. It has come from special procedures of the UN system, who have repeatedly stated that the practices and the intent clearly coming from Israeli authorities has been very clear. For me, the question, I suppose, the reason why I called it, in addition to all the things that I've already said, is as South Africa moves towards this government of national unity chaos or drama, whatever it's going to look like, for me, the question is, many of the parties that the ANC is going to be talking to hold some seriously troubling views on this particular issue. And I am really curious to hear from you, from your guests, and other listeners, what do we think will happen to this fundamental case before the International Court of Justice? Because it doesn't only matter for Palestinians in Gaza. It matters for any other country that may face similar violations. And the question around Minister Pandey's departure, also, it's not only about Palestine, it's also about the role that she has played at the African Union. None of these other parties, particularly the DA, and I'm going to go after them because their silence on the African Union system is highly problematic. What is going to happen with this GNU? Is it going to make any sense outside of the borders of South Africa? Thank you.
Much appreciated for those incisive questions and views that you expressed. So, I'd like to hear your thoughts, because there are the international legal instruments that opposition parties often say to South Africa that it must be subservient to. You'd recall the whole issue around BRICS and the Russian President Vladimir Putin entering South Africa. And I was asking the DA about some of the bigger principal issues that they are coalescing around. Wendy's right to ask this question. If South Africa points at Article 62 and the preamble of the construction of articles around the Genocide Convention, where will the critics stand?
Well, I think firstly, it's useful to go back to the UN Special Rapporteur's report in March this year, towards the end of March this year. She explained that genocide is a specific set of acts. And she said, this is now, I'm quoting from her report, specifically Israel has committed three acts of genocide with the requisite intent. Mm. One, causing serious bodily harm or mental harm to members of the group. Two, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. And three, imposing measures intended to prevent birth within the group. She went on to say that genocide in Gaza is the most extreme stage of a long-standing settler colonial process of erasure of native Palestinians. So I think she's made it very clear, and she is a legal expert. And, of course, it was further underlined by the South African team at the ICJ, using specific language similar to that of Ms. Albanese, to show that, indeed, not one condition for genocide, but at least three and possibly five conditions for genocide have actually been met.
And you know, I want to just jump in here, Aisha. Sure. There was criticism towards the UN Special Rapporteur on health about the conditions in Gaza about this, and the definitive language that she used here. But I want to go to the stewardship of this narrative, the process by Dr. Naledi Pandor. She has been ridiculed. She has been undermined, and all
There's
kinds of attacks
her
against her.
Her family's been threatened as well, yes.
So going forward, what do you think it's going to look like, this battle? And I say that keeping in mind that South Africa, as it prepares for its leadership of the G20 and the kind of pressure that it's faced because of the stance that it's taken?
Well, I think, Dr. Pandor has actually shown the kind of statesmanship in international relations under her leadership, both within the AU and further afield within BRICS and within the UN system, including at the ICJ. She has shown the kind of statesmanship in international relations that we have not seen in our foreign affairs since perhaps the days of the late Alfred Nzo. And, she has clearly brought once more to the fore the principle that Mr. Mandela heavily emphasized during his presidency, that South Africa's foreign relations is predicated on upholding human rights everywhere, not just in one place, but not in the other, and so on. So I want to say on that point, the other thing that South Africa going forward, we don't know who will succeed Dr. Pandor. We know that she is not on the list of MPs presented. Of course, Mr. Ramaphosa, if he does become president, or whoever becomes president next week, will have the leisure to appoint two non-MP ministers to his cabinet, but we don't know who those will be as yet. And we don't know whether Dr. Pandor will actually accept. One would hope that she does, but I'm sure there'll be glee in some quarters if she is not reappointed to the post, because there has, as you've been saying, a lot of criticism, heckling, even, mocking and condemnation of her. And she's borne all of that with absolute grace. I would like to see, however, going forward, that not only does South Africa continue to uphold the human rights of Palestinians and to protest against the genocide and bring legal action against the genocide and ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians, but currently there is another genocide happening right here on our continent, in a country that's very, very close to my heart, and that is Sudan. At least 14,000 people have been killed, and hundreds of thousands are on the brink of famine as well. And we can go into the reasons for that genocide at another time and place, but suffice to say that some of the same factors that played into the Darfur genocide in the early 2000s, the early to mid-2000s, and I made many trips to Darfur and to Sudan in that time. Many of those are carry-on effects that are now coming to fruition in the current genocide. And South Africa should certainly be raising our voice and bringing legal action against the RSF and indeed against the military in Sudan for what is currently happening there.
I don't, and you're absolutely right, it is something definitely worth talking about and delving into deeper without having the usual surface discussion. But I don't want to miss the opportunity to talk about this. You spoke about cultural memory obliteration. The report said 206 archaeological and heritage sites have been destroyed thus far. I want to talk about the importance of this. The old saying of history is often written by the victors.
The victors.
The generations and generations of Palestinians who have not been able to live until a certain age. What is the importance of this destruction for future generations to understand contextually what has been going on?
It is of the utmost importance. Imagine, Sipiso, a family where 70%, 80% of the family members, I'm talking now of an extended family, 80% of them have been murdered in the last 8 months in one family. But not only have those physical lives been destroyed, whether those are the lives of adults, children, elders, whatever, women, men, etc. But not only has that been destroyed, homes have been destroyed. Furniture that has been lovingly crafted has been destroyed. Photographs, which are the repositories of memory and of ancestral memory in many cases, have been destroyed. Cultural implements, musical instruments, the paraphernalia and costumes for dance, for cultural occasions, for weddings, all of that has been destroyed. Recipes have been destroyed. You know, one of the ways in which Israel and the Zionist movement have attempted to destroy Palestinian culture is by appropriating its food culture. I actually did a radio program on this with the world celebrity chef Sami Tamimi, he of the Ottolenghi restaurants fame and Jerusalem books fame, right? And we took a deep dive into this. You know, recipes are repositories of memory. I have recipes, as I'm sure you have, that are not only my mother's, but my mother's mothers and her mothers. And these are things we carry with us. Our recipes, our food culture, our music culture, our storytelling culture, our oral and written storytelling culture.
I hate to cut you off. It's a very important discussion, but unfortunately, I'm literally down to the wire. But thank you very much for spending time with us and just sharing your thoughts and educating
us. Thank you for having me.
Aisha Kaji, international relations expert. And I want to reflect back on Wendy's comment about language, context, the rights of linguistic minorities, not calling this conflict. Because what has often been said, the unequal military might, but, you know, giving dignity and respect to the people who are undergoing what is happening in Palestine. From the point of view team, thank you so much for joining us here, Mkaya. It is literally just gone 10 o'clock, and do enjoy the rest of your evening. We'll see you tomorrow.
you missed it live, catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.